pray. Lord, at the beginning of this high moment of life, we come with a sense of gratitude to ask your blessing upon us in these moments. We pause in prayer, Father and Son, Mother and Daughter, Husband and Wife, to breathe a prayer of thanks for making this moment possible. May the struggle and sacrifice that this hour bears witness to be not in vain. Save us, we pray, from all sins of intellect, not only from the error and ignorance that belong to our frailty, but from the pride that would make us think ourselves sufficient for our task. In the midnight of trial, may the mettle of our lives, the courage born of faith, the hope springing from within free men, enable us to meet all the demands of the day. And thou, God, be pleased to establish the work of our hands, yea, the work of our hands, establish thou it, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
In all literature, there is no finer expression of the power of music than John Dryden's Ode in Honor of St. Cecilia's Day, Alexander's Feast. The great 17th century English poet, in a half dozen melodious and unforgettable stanzas, celebrates the effect of old Timotheus' music making upon the youthful Persian hero, King Alexander, as the ancient lyrist deftly probes the themes of triumph, power, pleasure, pity, love, and revenge. On this score, history leaves little doubt. Music does have the power to soothe the savage breast, as well as the power to drive nations to war. It brings persons together and keeps peoples apart. Perhaps if more were known about music by more of us, perhaps if we spent a bit more time with music, perhaps if we let down somewhat our defenses against intrusion, music, the right music for each of us, whatever that might be, could lessen frustration and reduce tensions among nations as well as within individuals. Reduction of tension is an essential prelude to peace. Better music than scopolamine, or Milltown, or hypnosis, or some yet undiscovered nerve ray. Might not a research project of space age magnitude, probing in depth the potentials of music, suggest ways of constructing bridges of understanding among peoples that could restrain or even eliminate the ever-present savage urge among us to destroy one another? Of all the arts, to its advantage, music speaks a universal language. With music, there need be no barrier to communication. Robert Shaw, in his great performances in South America and in Soviet Russia, found none. With his music, he found no barrier to communication. In many respects, it would be difficult to imagine temperaments more unlike than the Latin and the Slav. Yet the response of both to Robert Shaw was genuinely, wholeheartedly enthusiastic. And this, of course, is a splendid tribute to the genius of the man and to the superb skill of his talented music makers. It is a thoughtful reminder, too, of the potency of sound, harmonious and melodic. Our tribe is known by the food it eats and by the cacophony of sounds that soothe and excite it. Now, a little music, like a single mosquito, can be an irritant, but a reasonable number of mosquitoes may not be so bad. They keep you busy enough to take your mind off your other troubles, and so perhaps with a reasonable amount of music. Robert Shaw, during the years you have so brilliantly conducted the superb performances of the Anchorage Festival of Music, you have charmed and captivated and conquered the hearts of Alaskans. We are indeed appreciative. We are truly grateful. We're hopeful there is more, much more to come. You have brought us music to match our mountains. With your coming, our hills exult, and our valleys caressed by sun and wind and your chorale do laugh and sing. Under your baton, the great land becomes a happy land. Robert Shaw.
Mr. Rasmussen, distinguished guests, members of the faculty of the University of Alaska, members of the classes of 1963, fellow students. The teacher and the conductor have this much in common. Each is smart enough to know that he can't carry so outrageous a personal display without significant outside help. The politician and the teacher from his rostrum has the lives and writings of great statesmen, or Socrates, or Einstein, to mask his own insufficiencies. And the conductor on his podium has the sounds and orders of great creative masters and the ministration of musical slaves to bridge the chasms of his own ignorance. In the very worst lecture or musical performance, something of value may happen. You can blunt the words of Lincoln or Jefferson, but they remain a dimly concealed weapon for truth. And in the performance of a great piece of music, there are so many millions of possibilities of error that no one man can make them all. Therefore, teachers and conductors are moderately, immodestly adept cowards. But the conductor who takes to the speaking rostrum is a fool as well and damned. For he's forgone his professional armor, white tie, tails, and jousting stick, which normally enable him to ward off the perceptive mind. And he's also without the genius and spirit of his creators with a small C. I'm embarrassed to report to you that I actually was asked if I would speak at this commencement and did not have the modesty to refuse. Just as with Sunday school picnics, pickles, and ice cream, the eyes were bigger than the butterflies in the stomach, and the mouth, which always was large enough to accommodate the foot, now handles both of them nicely. You could invite a few friends and hold a marathon. In educational circles, I think these are called seminars. I feel obliged to disclose to you amid all this pomp a circumstance which occurred in Cleveland a few months ago and which is related to this event today much as Cain was to Abel or Shelley Berman to Orville Wright. The family of which I am sire is not large in numbers, but its span is frequently beyond our grasp. There are a husband and wife in the conventional relationship, a daughter and son of college age, and some months back, 17 years behind this neatly balanced adult quartet, another son, aged 5, as of now. By some freak of academic and symphonic schedules, the entire family arrived in Cleveland during an Easter week of children's concerts. And Thad, 3 years old at that time, was spirited into the hall to hear his first symphony concert and for the first time see his father at work. Following the concert, his elder brother, thinking to surprise him with the sound of his own voice, interviewed the little one on tape in Daddy's office. How did you like the concert? Fine. What did you like best? Mr. Bernstein. So you can be sure that today's glory, however transitory, is truly restorative. The difference between success and successor is one of degree. As a matter of fact, one of the nice and provocative things about my sort of degree is that it cannot be earned, and therefore has a sort of fairy tale relationship to merit. Like having a policeman hand you a coupon, redeemable at traffic court for $2 in cash for not parking. All of us have witnessed, and probably have been disturbed by in recent years, the frequent embalming of the mind and spirit which attends the granting of graduate degrees or their purchase, perchance, at the wholesale level. I've seen enough of this in the large factories of New York to wonder that someone did not come off the delivery belt stamped Mr. Clean or Ajax or Geritol or Bufferin. And I invite all today to take delight in a degree totally and irretrievably unmerited, like salvation by grace or original sin with the fun thrown in. On the occasion of my first experience with this sort of function, the president of a liberal arts college in Ohio was carried so high into oratorical orbit by the citation handed him by the dean of the faculty that when it came time to say, and by the authority vested in me by the faculty and trustees, I hereby grant you the degree, he continued, of Doctor of Divinity. There was a low pressure area in the chapel as everyone drew breath at the same time. Personally, I was not at all surprised. Judging by what I had heard, it was the least they could do. Had it been a Catholic university, I should have been insulted by anything short of canonization. But the faculty finally, by murmurs and whispers, reached the president's ears, and when he had realized his error, he nonchalantly and trenchantly amended music, schmusic, divinity, schmivinity. In a matter of hours, no one will know the difference. Since that time, I've been severally, but I must say more straightforwardly, doctored. Some summers ago at a regular commencement at Pomona College in California, I was commenced along with some 250 or 300 candidates, some deserving and some honorary. The salutations, addresses, the announcements of prizes all were over, and people had settled down to the tedious business of watching the parade of graduates up to the platform to receive their union cards. The routine is familiar to everyone. The entire graduating class is lined up on one side of the stage in alphabetical order, Indian file. And all the diplomas are lined up in reverse alphabetical order on the other side of the stage. And in the middle stands the president or the president of the Board of Regents or something. And if a college isn't on its toes or somebody steps out of line, zowie, the platform is a backlash of robes, diplomas, mortared boards, and whimpering seniors. In most circles, the mortarboard is the clue to the whole thing, for once you become a Bachelor of Arts, you may wear your tassel on the right side. In barbershops, baseball parks, bowling alleys, there's absolutely no trouble telling a BA when you see one. So the secretary of the faculty reads the name on the diploma, Mariana Peppersmith, Bachelor of Arts, and hands the diploma to the president. Now, the president has a pretty good idea that it isn't Mariana Peppersmith at all. In fact, it looks a good deal more like Joe Pepper Schmidt. And still, one with the gowns and all, one could make mistakes. And he knows what can happen if he gets one bolt behind on the assembly line. So he looks Joe straight in the eye, calls out, Mariana Peppersmith, Bachelor of Arts, reaches out with his right hand to shake Joe's hand, extends the diploma with his left, and with his third hand reaches up, gets a grip on Joe's tassel, and flips it across from left to right. This is the reason for Joe's 4 years of struggle to get his tassel out of his left eye and into his right eye. Parents beam. It's a beautiful ceremony and a highly significant moment. But at Pomona, these moments had dragged into minutes and the minutes into hours, when suddenly a break came, and with it a roar of laughter and applause. Few of us caught the name, excepting his parents, but someplace down along the R's or S's and T's, as the president of the college reached up to flip the tassel, it stood straight up. It could not be brushed down, not forwards, not left, nor right. It had been wired. And in all fairness to the president, it is to be reported that he put up a short but vigorous tussle with Joe's tassel. But he lost, and the boy walked calmly across the stage, serpentined the front of the auditorium, and stood solemnly with the graduated part of his class to the cheers of those bored of education. After a completely warranted siege of letters, telegrams, and phone calls from your official family, who seemed to me unduly anxious to ascertain the range and trajectory of my discourse, I submitted the topic you now see printed before you, feeling about the plural noun that if I were to find anything harmless to say, the chances of it being in the field of the arts would be at least as great as in the field of military tactics, and finding a delight in the adjective such as Charles Adams might experience on Mother's Day, say it with fungus. For, of course, what I had very earnestly in mind were the liberal arts, so-called, tradition says, because their study in Roman days was accorded only to free men, and even of those liberal arts, more specifically that portion of them which we designate as creative, or occasionally seven and lively. The liberal creative arts, or the creative liberal arts. The word liberal by itself is not to be considered a dirty word. Befitting a man of free birth, unrestricted, bestowing in a large and noble way, open-handed, not narrow or contracted in mind, broad-minded, independent in opinion. We have a day named for independence. And of course, finally, not conservative. And precisely at this point, then, images and ideas and words crossed words, crossed swords. For let's all be liberal together. Neither is conservative a dirty word. In spite of the contemporary cross and backfire of piousity and poison, Judas and prejudice on either side, impregnable and ill-conceived, if conservative can literally mean conserving, preserving, then the topic has made its point. What do the liberal creative arts conserve? Absolutely nothing but humanity. And the argument then behind the topic is that the arts, and probably in direct ratio as to how liberal and creative they are the preservers of those values which define humanity and which divine divinity. And finally, in fact, may prove to be the only workable program of conservation for the human race on this planet. End of argument. I shall now proceed to paint myself into the only exitless corner on this kitchen floor. I ask myself a series of questions. First, what are the meanings of art? What is it trying to tell us of man? What is man trying to tell us of himself? Second, what may be the function or influence of art in a world gone schizophrenic, masochistic, pustulant? Third, what might be the place of art in a pioneering, developing society as, for instance, the state of Alaska? What occurred to me immediately was that if we could consider for a moment that Russians and Cubans and even possibly North by Northwest Americans were also human beings, then the answers to questions number one might also be able to tell us something concerning questions number two and three. And it occurred to me further that if we were to inquire into the nature of art, we might very well end by pondering the nature of man, which is a study proper enough. And in this regard, and at this point, we face the facts of this here now life. One, man stands, if not teeters, on the brink of self-annihilation. And two, to quote the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, there seems to be absolutely nothing that I can do about it. Number one, the sickness of society. Man has arrived at a position in his own scientific knowledge and competitive polity where he can reasonably hypothesize his own self-extinction. Governments, not for any lack of earnestness or endeavor, possibly even without malice, and for reasons which must be disturbingly unknown even to themselves, engage hourly and horrifyingly in a juggling and counter-juggling of propagandas, munitions, monies, and men, certifiable not even by the laws of average. And I ask myself parenthetically, is man really worth saving? Certainly all those born last night were, and my 5-year-old son, and everybody's children in college, none of whom has had the opportunity to merit the wind he inherits. But in spite of Socrates, Jesus, Beethoven, Shakespeare, Lincoln, Buddha, Gandhi, and a host of lesser saints, is it not possible, to paraphrase the psalmist, when I consider the earth, the work of my fingers, the horrors I have created, what is man that he is mindful of himself? Might it just not actually be that man is really not worth saving? There comes immediately another question, and it really is a half answer. On the other hand, could it be possible that human life itself, unclassified human life, is on the plus of creation's side? Not is this life or that life worth saving, not even is this life or that life worth dying for, but in view of the timeless, consciousless, upward climb of warm mud to cold man, is the life force in the man thing of itself a value and enough to save him from self-destruction? When table stakes are raised from trade routes and development rights through principalities and powers to man himself, absolute or obsolete, the game is not the same. Fact of life number 2, the lonely sickness in each man's soul. Familiar, no doubt, as well to kings, prime ministers, and presidents as to students, teachers, musicians, and bartenders, that there is indeed very little that I can do about it. They say this world is smaller now, but not my world. My world is full of hurricane and tide, of flux and flood, of thrust and space I never thought to face, and still no place to hide. This much moon I cannot bark down. The jailers of Paul and Silas at Philippi, originator of what must I do to be saved, was panicked only by an earthquake at midnight, not by how will you have your cities this morning, with or without people, or how do you like your children, crisp or scrambled. Which of us, simply by the accident of being born, and in personal as well as public affairs, does not find himself on a runaway rocket, blasting a trackless blackness, speed and destination out of sight, out of mind, out of control? What is man, and what can he do to be saved? Well, it is, of course, my suggestion to you that an attention to the conservative, liberal, creative arts may give us more than half answers and some help. I have not up to this point listed or defined those arts or this art, first because I feel that all of us would agree in general where they lie, certainly among the humanities, a designation which always amuses me by its implication that every other branch of human knowledge or endeavored must indeed be considered among the inhumanities. And second, because I have a suspicion, undeveloped as yet, that in the end, art may prove to be as much an attitude as an aptitude, as much a point of view as a product. And when I say art, then, I mean at least the languages and instincts and intentions of Beethoven, Shakespeare, Donatello, Bach, El Greco, and Picasso. What does this sort of art show itself to be? Why is it important, and how can it help us? I'd like to submit 4 answers. First, art on this scale is the most pervasive, persistent, powerful affirmation of the life force in the man thing. Than sex, it is stronger and longer, by centuries and by oceans. It is regeneration, reincarnation. It is the agony of resurrection. It is a true transubstantiation. Pitch into sonata form into spirit. Paint onto canvas into tears. Words onto paper across a proscenium into the heart of man. Essence inferred into substance achieved in order to communicate essence. Ally through all time of the evolutionary thrust, it is finally the flesh become word. In the second place, in the face of chaos, art is the recognition of isolate identity and the achievement of order. Facing the myriad phenomena of sensation, it is the ability to isolate the singular and the significant, that edge of color, this moment of pitch, yea, chip of marble, and so place it in the company of other identities, equally select and positioned, that the solo of the whole is greater than the chorus of its parts. Out of chaos, a creative spirit moving among the face of the waters, out of the random a rule, out of the countless and contrary the mask, the mark of one, integrity, entire, whole and holy. For pattern and order are very precious to art, and they form the center of its meaning. Matters of proportion, the relations of tone to timbre to texture, of rhythm to tempo, of expectation to continuation through recurrence to closure. These are not grandmother's ebonized and polished clothing tree, dunce capped and slack coated, tall in the hall while love is made in the parlor. Matters of proportion are at least root, trunk, branch and leaf, seed, sap and substance of art's meaning. Art is the achievement of order. The third aspect of art's meaning I find eloquently stated in a book of an English mathematician, J.W.N. Sullivan, entitled Beethoven, His Spiritual Development. It is Mr. Sullivan's contention that during the past few decades, the mechanistic theories which had ruled man's thinking for some 300 years have been severely shaken. For science has been able to provide knowledge of matter but not of essence, and that therefore matters of value, which have heretofore been ignored because they were not measurable, may still have something to say concerning the nature of reality. A work of art may indeed be a revelation. The higher consciousness of the creative artist is evidenced not only by the capacity of ordering his experience, but also by the capacity of having his experience. Beethoven lived in a universe richer than ours, in some ways better than ours, in some ways more terrible. And while he does not communicate his experience to us, he does communicate his attitude towards it. And we recognize his universe. We find it prophetic of our own. It is indeed our universe, but experienced by a consciousness aware of aspects of which we have but dim and transitory glimpses. And the reason that our reaction to a work of art cannot be adequately described is not that some unique and isolated faculty is involved, but that art is not superfluous, that it exists to convey that which cannot otherwise be conveyed. There is, after all, in man's being a mystery. The explosions of the known only enlarge the boundaries of the unknown. And it is peculiarly the discretion of great art, particularly great religious art, not to elucidate, but to illumine the unknown without engraving its image. And art exists to convey that which cannot otherwise be conveyed. The fourth mark of art's meaning I find in the simple fact that it is unremittingly an attempt to communicate, to establish contact, to find kinship even across centuries and oceans. It does too frequently seem to me that political and economic configurations, their facets running hot and cold, are more frequently divisive than comprehensive. Parenthetically and bitterly pathetically, we have a laboratory lesson in our own South. It is no longer a choice between segregation and desegregation, but between integration and disintegration. And it is to the credit of art and the arts that, except for short periods when they have been subverted and subjugated by politics or principles not their own, as in a Hitler's Germany or a Stalin's Russia, they have been a unifying force in the affairs of men, have promoted understanding and affection rather than half-truth and no trust. Art has instituted no crusades, has burned neither witches nor books. Indeed, in this respect, and perhaps because it has not been so institutionalized, great art, even more than established religion, has been the open hand of man reaching for his brother and the persistent focus of his goodwill. These may be at least some of the meanings of art, and advertently of mankind. There were two questions left. The first of them was, what hope can this offer to this abased and acneed face of the earth? Let me report to you what I've seen this past year. In October and November, a chorus and orchestra of 60 young professional musicians toured the Soviet Union as a part of our State Department's program of cultural exchange. We were there for 6 weeks. We gave 30 concerts in 11 cities. These concerts coincided precisely with the sharp edge of the Cuban crisis. While we might have expected demonstrations and picketing, there was only bravo and viva and ticket, ticket, who's got a ticket? Cheers and tears of thanks, good luck, and even God bless. In Leningrad, students and workers stood in line all night to receive a coupon which would allow them to stand in line all night the next night, which would allow them to stand in line the next day for the privilege to receive standing room at the concert as long as it was available. In the predominantly agricultural center of Lvov, peasants and students stopped the concert 3 times, bursting open the doors, only in order to keep from being crushed by the crowds on the streets pressing after them. In Moscow, the final week, there were units of militia stationed behind hastily erected steel fences at 10-foot intervals all day, light hours, and during concert nights to keep the public from getting into the hall to hide or to keep them from breaking the gates. An American embassy official was offered the price of 1 month's wages or a suit of clothes for one ticket to one performance of Bach's Mass in B minor. The night of the last Moscow concert, Bach's Mass in B minor was broadcast not only throughout the entire Soviet Union, but east and west into satellite countries. For 3 hours, the only fare available to the communist audience of X hundred million people was this monument of Christian creed, philosophy, and art. A minister of culture extending an official invitation to return asked if the repertoire might include Beethoven's Missa Solemnis and Wonder of Wonders, Bach's Passion According to St. Matthew, the bloody soul and center of Christian evangelism. Gifts which were proffered in return for the pleasure they said they had received were abstract paintings in the styles of Mondrian or Jackson Pollock, and even more poignantly, contemporary icons, Mary and the Christus, Out of Mother Russia by El Greco in the 20th century. What a strange twist to find this avant-garde, the independent and rebellious young, linked in youth to religious expression. I can recall that a quarter of a century ago in my college days, it was considered advanced to be agnostic. And this in a country, by its own proclamation and our promulgation, presumably materialistic and atheistic. How does one explain this? In the first place, in a snare of mutual misinformation and mistrust, what a solace must be the visitation only of goodwill. It is possible that still blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. In the second place, undoubtedly this music awakened in the hearts and memories of the very old, fragments of their unconscious, which caused them to weep, though they were not able to tell why. But thirdly, what of the young? What of those without memories of family or public worship? I submit that one can experience extreme difficulty in attempting to legislate out of existence the unknown. And fourthly, consider for a moment just the bare possibility that the Soviet people are enormously more sensitive to matters of the spirit than their party pronouncements or our own public press would lead us to believe. Listen to a fraction of a review published in the State Journal of the Arts following our return to the U.S. In what lies the immortality and eternal beauty of Bach's music? Why does it so excite, please, and move people at all times, including us, the people of the 20th century? Probably every generation has given and gives its own answers to these questions. The spiritual life of modern man is infinitely complicated. His thinking, memory, and aesthetic feeling are constantly developing. But still, the human principles that are characteristic of man were and remain immutable. They rest on principles simple and eternal as the world itself, truth, good, and beauty. All this the music of Bach reveals to us in forms which are simple and majestic, clear and infinitely wise. This music sings of life. It uplifts us, forces us not only to rejoice and to suffer, but most of all, to think. Who wrote that? The distinguished American trader Henry Thoreau, our own Prince of Apostasy, Ralph Waldo Emerson. I never sought to fail, our aged impresario said on the way to the airport. I was in every audience. Within 3 minutes after you'd begun to sing Kyrie Eleison, Lord our God have mercy, there were only silence and tears. And when you came to Dona Nobis Pacem 2 hours and a half later, grant us peace, there were night after night the strongest emotional tension and release I ever have witnessed. All sense of performance was gone. Only the spirit remained. Atheistic materialism? Not from where I stood. Now, what does all this accomplish? In the first place, I will have no traffic with the glib and pious prescriptive optimist who intones that the people who sing together will find peace together. Bourgeois. Evil is real in the world. Economic and political problems exist, and they're not going to be solved by going singing. But a generous and lively exchange of liberal arts can accomplish some things. It can gain us time, and it can give us the hope that if we understand each other so warmly and naturally in affairs of the spirit, we may one day be able to compose political and economic differences. And one other thing occurred to me on the plane flying back. In general, the intellectual and moral climate of our times is agreeable to the proposition that man does not live by bread alone. In Westchester County and other suburbia of the outside 48, they have it that man does not live by grass alone. Well, what we mean by it is that money, and even perhaps food, has ceased to be an end unto itself. We produce in order to buy the time, in order to build a healthy, happy physical life, and more importantly, a healthy, happy life of the mind and of the spirit. And it is precisely this interchange in medicine, architecture, poetry, philosophy, and music that is and should be the life of man. This is the dream that justifies political and economic activity, which validates it. Man does not live by bread, grass, economics, or politics alone. These adventures in exchange at the highest level of human aspiration are a sort of a beacon that it has happened, that it can happen, and that it must happen here. There's one last question I haven't touched, and I may be able to hint at it in a few sentences. The question as stated was, what is the place of art in the young, developing, pioneering society? Well, first, in reference to what has come down to us from the past, greatness is not the private property of some small coterie of hothouse sophisticates in New York, London, or Vienna. Great music is great precisely because it calls out to something so deep and constant in the human thing, because it carries something so native and true to the human spirit that not even knowledge of how it is done can kill the magic. Popular music is not the people's music. The people think so little of it that every 6 to 16 weeks they demand a new tune to dance to trade small talk above, to make what some call love by. Great art is known. It's available. The only thing we have to fear is understanding it. If we are not afraid to understand, we can. In terms of the past, only the best is good enough. And in terms of the present, the significant truth is that art is not really importable. Each man makes his own, whether he wants it or not. Each man has to be his own artist or perish. For finally, the understandings of the spirit are not easily come by. It takes a creative mind to receive the Creator's mind. It takes a Holy Spirit to receive the Holy Spirit. And just as I am is not nearly good enough. There's no pablum diet for truth, and no landscaped approach to beauty. You knock down the fences in your mind one by one. You finally realize that the mind and the spirit are not poles apart, that intelligence and the heart do not cancel each other, that if you can finally comprehend how a work is constructed, it is not proved to be a machine. You scratch and you scramble over intellectual difficulties. You get mad and you curse your own weak little mind, and you cry and you quit every day. But every once in a while, running around the bones, you see blood, and every once in a while, you hear music. Ladies and gentlemen of the class of 63, consider the creative arts. They toil and they spin unceasingly. Yet I say unto you that mankind in all his glory is only arrayed by such as these.
Sometimes, while doing the supper dishes, Walter Mitty and I make daring raids on enemy strongholds. And sometimes, between feeding the dogs and tossing the cat out to chase sparrows, we zoom around the country setting new airspeed records. It's not difficult if too many cups and saucers don't spin out of control. And when such disaster strikes, there's apt to be an admonition from the next room where some teenagers we know are busy with their homework while we're doing the dishes. Now and again, Walter and I dash off to remote corners of the world to strike oil and gas. No trick at all. Gas, it seems, is always with Walter and me. And we carry on some pretty tricky scientific and technological work, too. And then we met a man who had actually done far more exciting and important things than any we had imagined, even at our wildest. After that, we just kept our feet on the kitchen floor and did the dishes quietly. Deflation set in, but there was a considerable savings in breakage costs. For too many years, and now Time magazine will be featuring on its cover the 20th century man. In 1963, it's not too early to wonder just what some of the criteria selection may be. A true symbol of the 20th century would most certainly possess daring. This would be something far more than physical courage or boldness. It would be daring of the intellect and of the spirit as well. It would be the will to challenge old and treasured concepts. A man chosen to epitomize the 20th century would most likely be a product of a university or other center of learning of quality. He would possess and exercise intellectual discipline, however acquired. He would advance knowledge as well as apply it. The 20th century man, to reflect symbolically the memorable events of the age, would certainly have fought in defense of his country and his country's ideals in some capacity or other. He would be experienced in the successful management of business or industrial enterprises. He would possess and exercise knowledge of both the practical and the theoretical. And surely, the one selected to represent the 20th century would be internationally minded. His career would have demonstrated his strong belief in both the independence of man and the interdependence of the peoples of the earth. For his good works, as well as his sound ideas calculated to contribute to the evolution of peace among men, he would have been honored by many nations, both the slight of strength and the mighty. Upon the basis of these and other criteria, when the proper time arrives, I have a candidate to present as a symbol of the 20th century. But whatever the outcome of the selection process for such recognition, the candidate presented here today is certain to be on everybody's all-time, all-American. How vividly we remember that when there came a need for dramatic expression of a nation's will to win, the boy from Nome dared to be the hero from Shangri-La. I am honored to present Lieutenant General James H. Doolittle.
President Wood, members of the faculty, honored guests, graduates. It is a pleasure for me to be here with you today, and it is a distinct honor to be invited to speak to the 1963 graduating class of the University of Alaska. I know how important an occasion graduation is in the lives of young people. It is a high point of personal history for each of you. and I am indeed gratified that you have asked me to share this experience with you. I hope I'll be excused if I use this platform somewhat differently than is common practice. At a time when it is customary for the speaker to look only forward into the years ahead, I would like to look a little at the years past. I realize it is expected that I should talk of the opportunities and problems which lie ahead, and I shall. But it is difficult for me to break completely with the past, for in coming here today, I have returned to the home of my youth. I lived in Nome 80 years ago as a youngster and spent my early grammar school years there, as well as my first silver dollar. The dollars I earned delivering copies of the Nome Nugget and in the summertime, the Seattle PI. I left Nome in 1908 and didn't return until 1948, 40 years later. I was amazed at the inaccuracy of my recollection and how changed the area had become. It was a powerful illustration of the fallibility of the human memory. However, I would like to make this more than a pleasant flight into nostalgia and speak of the past in more than a personal sense, in a national sense. Hindsight, it has been said, is the clearest vision we have. By looking at the past, we can sometimes gain a clearer insight into the future. For it is in the past that the future really begins. We in this country have not thought about this too much because we like to believe that our roots are planted in the present, that our past is so recent, and the years of it so meager, that there really isn't much to it. This is not so. For while we are in some things young and dynamic, we are in others old and stable. We're the oldest large democracy on earth. Our basic form of government has not changed since its beginning, and we're the only major power with this record. Consider the political upheavals which have changed the form of governments during the past 100 years in France, Germany, Russia, Italy, China, Austria, Japan, Egypt, and even England. Since our Civil War, nearly a century ago, we have shown a political stability which has been as steady as Rome at her most mature epoch. We do have a heritage of history, and it is one of which we can be proud. As it is true that each generation inherits the earth, it is equally true that your great new state has inherited the glorious past of the United States. It has inherited also some of the dangers which threaten the present and darken the future. Because of the accident of geography, and the confluence of many military technologies at this time, Alaska is in the very forefront of these dangers. Here, the two great land masses of the Asian and North American continents nearly touch, and the two protagonists stand in line of sight proximity to one another. Here in the north is the crossroad, the uneasy frontier between East and West. Somehow, though, the word frontier, with its classic implications of rugged simplicity, primitiveness and isolation, does not apply to modern Alaska. There is nothing isolated about its Cold War position, nor as long as it stands 55 miles from the Soviet mainland, nothing primitive about its defenses, and nothing simple about its political, military, economic complex of problems. The word frontier rather belongs to the quality of the people who have come here to live and work and accept the dangers and the challenges that this area has had thrust upon it. What motivates the sourdough? Not the Spartan living, nor the economic inducement, nor the longing for escape from more highly developed and crowded societies, although I suppose there are elements of each of these in the motivations which bring and keep people here. Basically, it is the profound conviction that there is a new and growing importance to this land, that Alaska, in the forefront, is a land of opportunity, that new ideas and new technologies have greater applications here than anywhere else. Certainly, this is true of defense applications. Presently, Alaska's number one industry is defense of our country. This state's importance as a vital defense zone has long been recognized by military authorities. In his memoirs, General Hap Arnold, the great leader of our Air Forces during World War II, said, Alaska has always been, and no matter what happened in any theater of war, always remained to me privately a high priority. Billy Mitchell, the great military prophet of this century, more than three decades ago said, "He who holds Alaska holds the world." But Alaska's importance is not only military. Energy, heat and power, from coal, oil, and the controlled atom, with the help of technology, will unlock Alaska's tremendous resources and develop her industries and her commerce. New methods of local transportation and the polar air routes across the roof of the world will provide the communication system which will link this state even closer to the rest of the Union and to the world. I am satisfied that the great wealth locked for centuries in the nature's frozen fist here will one day be pried out by eager Alaskans with the new technologies which are now being developed. The Great Circle Route is, as you know, the shortest distance between two points on the Earth's surface. From a commercial viewpoint, Fairbanks lies almost exactly on the Great Circle Route between Chicago and Tokyo. And from a military point of view, the routes from Omaha to Peking and from Honolulu to Moscow both cross Alaska. You young people are graduating into the front line of the Cold War. You are stepping into a war which is older than any of us, older even than I am. It dates back over 100 years to 1850, when Karl Marx enunciated his manifesto. He said, "It is our interest to make it, the revolution, permanent until the proletariat has conquered state power in all of the dominant countries of the world." And 46 years ago, in 1917, Lenin said the same thing more specifically when he threatened that world imperialism cannot live side by side with the victorious Soviet Revolution. And in 1920, he said, "As long as capitalism and socialism, communism, remain side by side, we cannot live peacefully. The one or the other will be victor in the end." The threat was more clearly stated, as if it needed clarity, when Stalin said, "The goal is to consolidate the dictatorship of the proletariat in one country, using it as a base for the overthrow of imperialism in all countries." And Khrushchev said it with the finality of a cymbal crash. "We will live to bury you," he told us. The Soviet threat is unchanged and very real. It is not, however, as long as we continue to recognize it, the primary danger to our nation. This is because it is visible, and because we have already successfully met it in places like Berlin and Korea. The greatest danger, and the answer to the Soviet threat, is within ourselves. It is easy temporarily to strengthen our defense establishment with tax dollars, which will buy more missiles and better airplanes. But our national strength is not only in our weapons or in our economy. It is in the will, the ambition, the intelligence, and the integrity of our people. It is difficult but imperative that we strengthen ourselves individually. This is a lonely process, studying by the midnight lamp, sacrificing our leisure time today so we may have a better tomorrow, disciplining ourselves to reach higher standards. This, you, class of 1963, have been doing. We must continue to dedicate ourselves to higher ideals, to morality, to hard work, to sacrifice, and to patriotism. Our president a few years ago said, "It is not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." This is a very good definition of that oft-maligned word, patriotism. We in the United States have had it easy relatively for a long time. Many of our people have become soft and lazy. They incline to procrastinate. Today, I want to make a plea for excellence. This excellence is developed and sharpened in the university, but the maintenance of it is a continuing, lifelong project. The greatest enemy to our way of life is mediocrity. This is the acceptance of those standards which are the easiest to attain. Our country and your state were not built by mediocre men, by conformists, by the good enough folks. They were built by dedicated patriots and pioneers. Herbert Hoover very clearly expressed these thoughts when he said, "If we are to have leadership in government, in science, in education, in the professions and in the home, we must find and train some uncommon men and women. Let us remember that the great advances have not been brought about by mediocre men and women. Rather, they were brought out by distinctly uncommon men and women with vital sparks of leadership. Men and women like St. Francis of Assisi and Florence Nightingale and Abraham Lincoln. Many of these great leaders were, it is true, of humble origin, but that was not their greatness. When we go to war, said former President Hoover, we yearn for an uncommon general or admiral. When we choose the president of a university, we want an uncommon educator. When I am sick, like Herbert Hoover, I want an uncommon doctor. I think Tom Watson, Jr., the president of IBM, put it even more dramatically when he said, "You can make wild ducks tame, but you can never make tame ducks wild again. The duck who is tame will never go anywhere anymore." And Mr. Watson added that he is convinced that any business needs its wild ducks. He obviously means the individual with courage, ambition, self-confidence, imagination, and initiative. Not the chap who wants only security, who is satisfied just to be fed and cared for. General Douglas MacArthur, in his stirring address to the Corps at West Point last June, outlined our obligation and our heritage in three powerful words: duty, honor, country. He bespoke the military leader's code of excellence. It befits all of us. You who are graduating today, I envy you your timing. You are moving into a dynamic world which is very exciting. Part of the excitement is its very danger, for the biggest danger is to be unprepared for danger, and I do not believe this is the case with you. I salute you, University of California graduates of 1963. You are ready for the free. Pray. You are the uncommon Alaskans. I wish you opportunity, luck. Luck which usually follows careful planning and strenuous effort. Success, good spirit, and happy adventure.